anything on your phone, any kind of list on your phone that you're scrolling through.
Not even worth it.
Yeah. You get through like two and you're like, I want to know what the 25 X-Men that will never appear on screen are. And you get through two of them and you're like, duh. Of course, Marrow will never be in a movie. And then this giant pop-up comes up and you have to click exit and it takes you back to the top of the article and you're like, fuck me. I already got through two.
Right.
I'm not doing this list again.
And then it takes an entire lunch just to be able to...
An entire lunch over a stupid listicle that I'm not even reading the actual text. I'm literally just reading the numbers.
Welcome to another episode of Jabber on the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. From San Diego, California, you are Keith Foster.
That's right. And this week, also in San Diego, California, is Cassidy Robinson, who is from Los Angeles, California, but he is in my living room.
Yes, we are recording from Foster Kids Studios right now. Isn't that your fake production name you've been using since high school?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, my website's Keith Foster Kid. Oh, yeah, I have a website now.
Yeah. I figured we'd probably bring that up at the end when you do your plugs, but...
Oh, we will again. But, you know...
Pepper it in.
How many people listen to more than the first 10 minutes of this podcast anyway?
You're probably right, so get it out while you can.
Yeah, go to www.keithfosterkid.com to see all the shows I'm not doing.
Except for this show.
Yes. There is a link to this show, actually, on my website.
I saw. I made sure.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you would have got a very angry text message.
No, I wouldn't have.
No, you would have got a passive-aggressive text message.
Hey, why is the podcast not on your website?
It'd be cool if you could just put a link or like something at the bottom, maybe.
I don't know. Just
whatever.
Like, yeah, it'd be cool.
Right. So it's the 4th. We're actually recording on the 4th.
Yes, we are recording instead of watching fireworks because Trump is president.
Right. Well, I was going to say we have our sparklers lit. We have our MAGA caps on.
Oh, I'm wearing all black, mourning the death of America and democracy.
Like a pink Okami fascist.
Yes.
Yes.
All pink. This podcast was brought to you by Russia.
Okay. Yeah, new environment, new everything. We didn't have a show last... Well, I did a show with a guest last week, but we didn't have a show together.
Yeah.
What have you been up to? What have you
been doing? I've been very busy trying to buy a house.
Oh, yeah.
It's been very time-consuming and stressful and insane, but also very exciting. And I think we might have found a place, but it's... It's a pretty sure thing, but it's not 100% sure. So, you know, by the next time we record, I will either be very happy about the situation or very sad.
Mm-hmm. You will either have a house or you'll be totally homeless.
Yes.
Nowhere in between.
Living on the streets, just clicking refresh on my website, hoping to God somebody books me for a gig.
Begging for money with improv.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's essentially what the improv life is.
Right. I don't think I've done anything particularly cool.
You came to San Diego.
Yeah, I did that. I wanted to take some time and be able to take a holiday off. All of last year during work, I worked every single holiday.
Did you get, like, mad cash?
There's a couple days where we get time and a half, so that was nice. But, yeah, you know, I didn't make any plans. Nobody really was doing anything in particular. So I was just basically didn't bother requesting anything off.
I think that, like, in your 30s, holidays don't really exist or matter if you don't have, like, kids.
Yeah.
Like, most holidays, I could kind of take it or leave it. Mm-hmm. I mean, me and my wife will do stuff. So, you know, like, we'll try to plan stuff because it's a holiday, but we don't really care. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's 2017 and God is dead. That is my motto for the year.
Right. People think you're kind of strange when you're, like, running down the street screaming that.
Yeah, 2017, God is dead, nothing matters, everyone's an asshole.
Very patriotic.
Happy 4th of July.
Actually, this is a movie podcast, and we'll be talking about a couple movies. Actually, we're catching up on things. We're going to be talking about Baby Driver, the new Edgar Wright film.
It is not a movie about a baby that drives.
Yeah, so I'm so disappointed. I thought it was going to be Uber Presents Baby Driver, the first baby Uber driver.
I thought it was a sequel to Baby's Day Out, mm-hmm. Baby Driver. Baby's Day Out 2, Baby Driver.
Right. It is neither of those things. We are also talking about the Tupac Shakur biopic, All Eyes on Me.
I will also be talking about the Netflix homework I assigned Glengarry Glen Ross, which you didn't watch.
No, and this is 2 weeks in a row where the dog ate my homework, but in this case, Netflix ate my homework.
Wait, 2 weeks in a row?
Yes, last week when I recorded with Amanda Kowalski, friend of the show Amanda Kowalski, she wanted me to watch Pedro Almodovar's Bad Education, but I wasn't able to log into Hulu and couldn't see it.
Why the fuck do we even do this segment?
I know. I'm the worst. But in this case, Glengarry Glen Ross.
Okay, I actually have a story about Glengarry Glen Ross. So, my wife suffers from gallstones every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
It's very painful. It's very unfortunate things she has to go through. Last Sunday, we went to a production of Richard II at the Old Globe Theater. It was hurting her so bad that we had to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, at least I could watch the Netflix homework at home. You're in pain. We could at least be at home and I could watch the Netflix homework because I would not have had time to watch it mm-hmm. otherwise. So my wife was in, like, an unsurmountable pain in the bedroom, going through these gallstones, and I was doing my assignment watching the Netflix homework. Yeah.
Right. Just so everybody knows, even though you are going to be talking about Glengarry Glen Ross, if you so choose, it is not on Netflix anymore. They pulled it. Because it is not a perfect system and is not an apt replace for the video store, and they randomly like to upload and then take off and then upload again movies without telling people.
That's true. That actually supports my decision to still own physical media.
Right.
Because most of the time I'm like, I could just watch it on Netflix or HBO or whatever. But there are some things that I'm like, I don't want to risk it. Like, I want to have this movie, access to this movie at all times. Because mm-hmm. they do that.
They do that a lot. And they did do that with this last movie. But let's go ahead and get into the movie news.
Movie news. Talking about that movie news.
And we have a few stories that were backed up from the last couple weeks. And we'll start with this one in The Hollywood Reporter. Hugh Jackman to play Gary Hart in Jason Reitman's political drama. In case nobody knows, Gary Hart. Let me see. I'm sure it'll say somewhere in here.
I think you scrolled. He was considered the front runner for the 1988 Democratic presidential nomination when his campaign was rocked by revelations of an extramarital affair with Donna Rice.
Yes, and it was on a boat. He had a boat that was named like something ridiculous, like Love Machine, like that on the nose.
That's pretty good. I mean, if you're gonna have an extramarital affair,
yeah,
it should be on. Was it called the Love Boat?
It was something that on the nose, but I don't think it was that exactly.
Was it called Deep Dickin' Gary Hart's Love Cruise?
So, like, I'm telling you, it's cartoonish. Yeah, so
Gary Hart's full steam ahead to the orgasm dock.
So friends of the show, Patrick and Dennis, they did a whole show on Almost Educational. They did a show about alternate realities of if different elections went differently. And they talked about Gary Hart in the episode, and it was the first I'd ever really heard about this nominee. And they made the great point of, you know, he was a great progressive. Everyone really liked him. He had a really good platform. And then, like Democrats like to do, they fucked themselves up with some scandal.
Mm-hmm. So 88, would that have been Bush Senior?
Yeah. So that would have been Dukakis ended up being the nominee instead.
Ugh. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. This could be good. I like Hugh Jackman. I'm interested to see Hugh Jackman's post-Logan work. Mm-hmm. His post... Because honestly, like, name a Hugh Jackman joint outside of X-Men that you enjoy.
The Prestige.
Okay. Sure. How long ago was that?
A really long time ago.
Yeah. I mean, he's... I love Hugh Jackman, but he has a tendency to get attached to projects that I don't really give a shit about. Mm-hmm. Like, I was not into Australia.
Yeah, or what was that one? Peter Pan thing?
Yeah. With his weird, like,
Joe
what
Wright.
The fuck was that?
A movie that barely happened.
Yeah, it was like a prequel to Hook. I guess Peter Pan is a prequel to Hook.
Right.
But like is a prequel to Peter Pan where Captain Hook is... wasn't it like Magneto? What?
Which Magneto?
Fassbender, wasn't he?
Michael Fassbender. I don't remember. I just remember it coming out and then not.
He was like
anything.
A young, sexy Hook. That's all I remember. So I feel like, I don't know, it's a good, probably post X-Men universe move for Hugh Jackman, just to see him do something a little more grounded, a little more politically charged is cool.
Yeah. Something that's outside of the sci-fi fantasy sort of Comic-Con realm.
Yeah. We had an error in the recording, so I don't know if we picked up your massive eye roll for Jason Reitman or not. I just want the podcast listeners to know that you were talking about Jason Reitman is a good director, and then you stopped, did the giant eye roll and sigh, which I'm sure our listeners are very familiar with. Yeah.
Well, I had to edit myself because I started by saying that he's a director that I'm very interested in because going back, I loved his first film, Thank You for Smoking. I really liked Up in the Air. I really liked Juno. And then his last two movies in a row, he released, I think in the same year even, was a 1-2 punch of bad movies. The one, I think it was, what was that called? Like Labor Day or something?
We Bought a Zoo. No, I know that's not him.
That's
but
the other one.
That's just my favorite name for a bad movie ever.
I reference
that movie, by the way, constantly, and people don't know what the fuck I'm talking about. But I'll just, like, somebody will be like, yeah, I bought a car. And then I'll be like, We Bought a Zoo. And they're just like, okay. What are you saying right now? That has nothing to do with Jason Reitman.
No, that's Cameron Crowe's bad movie.
Yeah. He's had a few.
He's had a few. But, so he made that movie Labor Day with Kate Winslet and Josh Brolin that nobody saw. Then
that's what it was.
Shortly thereafter, he made Men, Women, and Children, which was at his, like, anti-internet, like... my favorite thing was one bad review called it the Reefer Madness for the internet.
I didn't see that movie. I was very disappointed, though, because I remember from the trailers, it looked like an actual decent turn for Adam Sandler.
Right.
And then I just heard it. I didn't really hear much about it. Just that it wasn't
He was
good.
In it.
Yeah.
He was in it. He has a track record of, like, picking, like, the wrong off-brand stuff, like The Cobbler.
Yeah.
And then that one. Like, two really great directors. Like, he should have...
Yeah, it should, on paper, it's like, all right, I'm going to finally get out of my rut and people are going to start taking me seriously. Go, 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 go.
Right. And then he happens to be in the one or two stinkers these directors have ever made.
Yeah, and he's like, I guess I'll just go back to being this guy.
Right.
Anyway,
But yeah, I think this is an interesting story at the very least. And I think that Jason Reitman knows how to work with leading men and especially characters who are sort of sleazy, but maybe have a good heart, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I'll say I'm cautiously optimistic for it.
Right. Okay, and then the other story that we did...
Yeah, we did... I'm so excited for the listeners
to... We're play-acting right now.
Yeah, we did like half the podcast, and then there was a glitch in the Matrix. So there's like all of this riffing that was missed, all of this delightful stuff.
You're getting refried podcasts right now.
There's a missing podcast lost somewhere that you'll never hear. never.
We didn't do that much, but we did do this story. Did we do the Nightcrawler story already?
We did. We did basically all the movie news.
Right, yeah. So
the story is that the team of Jake Gyllenhaal, Rene Russo, and Dan Gilroy are reuniting for a Netflix film.
The article doesn't specify very many plot details other than it takes place in the art world. Whatever that means, doesn't give us an era, doesn't give us any specifics about what kind of art?
Oh, they missed my fuck Johnny Depp rant. And with zero context for why Johnny Depp came up in this conversation. Long story short, fuck Johnny Depp.
Right. He's really mad about Johnny Depp for some reason. But, because we were talking about how I am excited about Jake Gyllenhaal.
We don't need to go there.
We don't have to go there, but I do. I'm still interested in this aspect of the story.
Yeah.
I think Jake Gyllenhaal is in a really interesting place in his career right now. And I compared him to, like, mid-90s Johnny Depp when he was doing one interesting thing after another and was kind of unpredictable, taking a lot of character roles.
And I was upset that you even brought Johnny Depp up. Because fuck Johnny Depp.
Right.
Anyway, and then there might be a segment in the future where I just tell celebrities to fuck off.
Yeah, because it's become a thing lately.
They fucking it's suck,
man. A reoccurring theme on the
podcast. Who watches The Watchmen? I do. I watch them. Anyway, they're teaming up for this Netflix thing. I don't really care until I know more about it. Mm-hmm. I get kind of sick of these promotional things just plugging creative teams because right. It always seems to disappoint me. Like, just because they did a cool thing once doesn't mean them working together will necessarily be cool again. Like, in my experience, it seems like lightning rarely strikes twice.
Right. But we've only gotten one film from Dan Gilroy as a director.
Sure.
He's written some films, but he's this Nightcrawler being his directorial debut is a damn strong first film.
That's true.
And it doesn't seem like the type of strength that's an accident. It seems like it's very studied and very assured directing. And of course, this isn't going to be a thriller. Maybe, we don't really know. But I'm excited to see what he does just as much as I am to see the team reunite.
Sure. And I like, that Rene Russo has had kind of a comeback,
Yeah.
Because
she was really good in that movie.
She's really good. And, if he can utilize her in a way that's like relevant again, that'd be cool.
Uh-huh. For sure. The last story that we covered
is the Kathleen Kennedy. You've scrolled past it. The Phil Lord and Chris Miller were fired from the Han Solo solo adventure,
right?
By Kathleen Kennedy.
Yes,
disgust. And
has been replaced by Ron Howard.
Yeah. You said you weren't really surprised by this.
No, because. Yes, so Phil Lord and Chris Miller kind of have a brand. That brand is sort of absurdism and satire. And
they have a postmodern take on things. They like to call attention to things.
To the fictitiousness of the property they're working with, or call attention to the property itself.
Yeah,
meta.
So one of the things I thought was interesting was. Apparently, according to all the gossipy reports, it was actually the actor who played Hobie Doyle in Hail Caesar. Cannot think of the actual actor's name.
Alden Ehrenreich.
Yeah, who's playing Han Solo. Apparently, he was, again, this is all rumor. None of this is verified, so I hope I'm not getting anybody in trouble.
Rumor.
Apparently, he was the one who had concerns with their direction, and he took it to Kennedy himself. Like, he, like, went up the chain of command. The report was saying that they were turning Han Solo into a Jim Carrey-like character, which had undertones of Ace Ventura. Right.
I'm making a face.
Yeah, it's a good face. It's a very appropriate face. Like, I can't even imagine what that
is. Does sound very behind Hollywood doors rumor mill.
Yeah.
And it's all unverified, obviously.
I'm not putting a lot of
NDA,
stake in,
so we'll never know.
It's just, it's such a specific complaint. Like, yeah. Like Ace Ventura isn't really on the cultural zeitgeist's mind anymore. So for that to even come into the conversation with Han Solo is weird enough and specific enough for me to be like, is
well, I think what we can take from that complaint is that they wanted the character to be big.
Probably cartoony.
And kind of cartoony. Yeah, which is why I said I'm not surprised by this. Given that they generally work comedically, they generally work in this sort of meta context. And so far, most of the Star Wars reboot stuff has been pretty sincere and down the line. And I feel like, you know, we've heard about Disney's clashing with directors. You know, we'll be talking about Baby Driver today, but obviously there was the big Disney versus Edgar Wright thing for Ant-Man. And that was sort of a similar situation, I feel, where his style is just too specific for the, a corporate bottom line.
It's getting interesting because, especially with Disney, we're seeing these sort of, we're going beyond just a franchise now.
Anyway, they're out. They're out. Kathleen Kennedy did not like their wacky shenanigans that they were pulling with Han Solo's solo movie. So in comes Ron Howard.
Right, so that's a big X factor in all of this, and I think it's very indicative of sort of what the studio's goals are for these projects in general. To go from two very idiosyncratic filmmakers who have a very specific vision for what they like to do, what they see as part of their brand, and to move on to somebody who's quite a bit safer, and I think a little bit more of a Ron Howard is something of a prestigious director in certain circles, but I think when it comes to this type of work, he's more about servicing the material rather than interpreting it.
Yeah, I agree. It's like, I mean, I will say at least Ron Howard is like a competent director. He's a good director.
Sure.
And I think he'll work really well within the Star Wars universe. But it's definitely like a safe pick.
Right. I've always considered him kind of a mini Spielberg.
Yeah, like Diet Spielberg.
Right. Yeah.
Spielberg Light.
Spielberg Tab. Crystal Spielberg.
Spielberg Zero. Spielberg Max.
No, I don't give you that one. That'd be more like James Cameron.
No, Max is, so Coca-Cola has the Zero line, like Coke Zero, Sprite Zero, that's their zero flavored sodas. Mm-hmm. Pepsi has Pepsi Max. It's the same thing,
right,
though.
Right.
I'm not saying he's like the maxed out version of Spielberg. No. I'm saying he's sugarless Spielberg.
Ah. Stevia Spielberg. Okay, moving on. Let's get into the movie reviews. And
yes.
We'll start the episode off with a review for Edgar Wright's Baby Driver,
Yes, not a sequel to Baby's Day Out.
Unfortunately.
Not in the Boss Baby verse.
No. All one movies of that movie universe.
It's actually, I don't know if you knew this, but every movie with the name Baby in the title is actually interconnected. So this is the same cinematic universe as Baby's Day Out. You just don't see any of that because it's in New York.
And Baby Geniuses, part one and two.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Let's not forget the Baby Geniuses movies.
Let's not. And I would have to say, you know, we haven't got into the full content of our reviews yet, but Baby Driver might be the best of the Babyverse movies.
I don't know. Have you ever seen Bringing Up Baby?
Oh, that's right. And there was a really good Barbara Stanwyck movie from the 30s called Babyface, too.
Yeah. Have we exhausted all the baby movies?
Not as much as we've exhausted alternative diet sodas.
Okay. Anyway.
What happens in this movie?
So there's this guy. His code name is Baby. He is a driver for a criminal organization. We find out that he made some mistakes when he was younger. He got indebted to this criminal guy. But he's sort of come up to be this driver savant as long as he's got his tunes.
Right.
So he drives for this criminal organization. He finally has paid his way out. He's doing one last job, and then things start to go awry. And for the first time in his life, he has real stakes involved.
Right, because he's just fallen in love.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Yeah.
We should mention some people who are in the movie. Ansel Elgort, kind of new to the world of film, I suppose. He's been up and coming for a little while. He plays
the
lead.
He is the titular baby.
He's the titular baber. Baber. He's the titular baby. John Hamm is in here as a criminal named Buddy. He has a girlfriend played by Aiza Gonzalez named Darlin. The barista that he falls in love with is played by Micah Howard.
No.
Lily James.
Yeah, she plays Deborah.
Right.
Not
right.
Barista. Barista
is not a character.
Yeah, how does Barista get title like higher billing than Deborah?
It's one of those stupid IMDb things where it's probably listed by appearance instead of
dumb. Yeah. Anyway, we've also got
K Space as the big bad.
Yes, he's the sort of the ringleader of the criminals, and then we've got Jamie Foxx as sort of the wild card, loose cannon.
Sure. There's a few different angles to kind of come at this review, and I think I want to start with... I was about to make a comparison the last time we tried to do this review, that, you know, the movie deals heavily in music and editing, and that's two things that Edgar Wright, as a director, has really loved to showcase his talents in.
Although I will say, unlike most Edgar Wright stuff, there's definitely a level of awareness here, but it's not as sort of ironic as, like, you know, some of the, like, the Cornetto trilogy could be.
Sure.
Or Scott Pilgrim. It's a pretty straightforward approach. I mean, his style is there, but he's actually
coming at it with wanting to really participate in the genre rather than sending it up.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that is one of the things that significantly removes this from his other work.
Sure, definitely. But like his other work, he does employ those quick kind of hip hop editing techniques. And the way that he includes the soundtrack, the needle drops in the background, instead of just music cues being used as score, it actually serves a story purpose as well.
Yeah. So the main character, Baby, he got in a car accident when he was little, which gave him tinnitus. So he has this ringing sound in his ears, and he has constantly listened to music to drown it out. And that helps him focus on driving, and also provides a really kicking background score.
Do you want to try that again?
Yes. And also provides a really kicking background soundtrack.
Right. as Edgar Wright is wont to do. You mentioned when we were talking off mic that there's a lot of similarities here that some could see from Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, certain plot things, maybe a tip of the hat to some of the character dynamics in Reservoir Dogs, and then plus like the planning scenes with the chalkboard and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like the whole warehouse
right.
just sort of gave me that Reservoir Dogs
Mercs
feel.
Mercs who also aren't allowed to know each other's names.
Yeah, and just like the hipster, like the dialogue is like slick as fuck.
Right, very quick.
Like it's cool. Like, Kevin Spacey is fucking cool in this.
Sure, yeah. And he also, he has that kind of weird paternal sort of vibe in the same way that Lawrence Tierney did in Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah. And also, sorry, to before we get into, like, characters and plot and stuff, sure. Going back to the music, there's this, like, opening sequence that is sort of like a credit sequence, but it's not. Mm-hmm. It, like, the opening, maybe, like, 15 minutes almost feels like a musical, like a reclaimed musical, like in the vein of like Baz Luhrmann or you know what I mean? Like,
sure, one of those kind of modern day sort of alt musicals.
Yeah, I read somewhere someone compared this, said this is the La La Land of crime movies.
Yes, actually, that was one of the things that came to mind when I saw this. I think the movie's very much structured like a musical. And even Tarantino has said, you know, like people have asked him sort of ironically as a joke, like, would you ever do a musical? And he said, like, I have a lot of music in my movies and they're, you know, they're cued a lot in a very similar fashion to old fashioned musicals on purpose.
Yeah. But I feel like this sort of takes that to the next level.
Yes. And actually, the movie that I thought about the most while watching this, of course, it obviously owes a ton of debt to Reservoir Dogs and Streets of Fire and the Walter Hill's work in general, The Warriors and The Driver, obviously most obvious, and then French Connection for the car sequences and that kind of stuff. But the movies that I was thinking about the most is one, La La Land, because we've just seen it, and this feels very tightly choreographed in a very similar way, and it's meta in a lot of the similar ways. Mm-hmm. And knowing that Edgar Wright is a big fan of campy cocaine musicals of the 70s, like Phantom of the Paradise and The Apple, the movie is in the crime milieu, and it's obviously making references to a lot of crime films. The movie reminds me the most of kind of his take on doing a big musical.
Yeah.
And even the violence and the action scenes are sort of sequenced more like choreography than they are like traditional sort of visceral action. Like,
yeah.
There a lot of scenes, the way they're cut and stuff reminded me a lot of West Side Story.
I can see that.
Yeah. But so in a way, like, you know, it kind of makes sense that the movie, like the central, like, stylistic theme is this whole idea of like the playlist in the background, because I feel like the movie is kind of a playlist of other movies, and that may or may not favor well with viewers. I like it.
Oh yeah, I totally like it. If viewers don't like it, they're wrong. Like, this movie's cool as fuck. I don't get that.
You don't get what? You don't get that its referentiality as being a negative?
No. I mean, look at this. It's the year 2017. Movies have been around for what? Almost 100 years now? Mm-hmm. More so? Right? Like there comes a point when I think, you know, have we gotten to the point where any kind of movie can already be made? I don't know. That's not my point. My point is, this movie definitely wears its references on its sleeve. But at the same time gives me something new and a fresh take on it. Like, yeah, it reminds me of Reservoir Dogs, but do I feel like it's ripping Reservoir Dogs off? No. You know, I feel like this is a totally different movie. This feels like Edgar Wright's movie. I feel like I'm getting the story of Baby. And so I don't think so. I appreciate movies that are aware of, you know, sort of the film history they come from. But, you know, that doesn't take away from the movie for me, as long as the movie is doing its own thing. And this one definitely is.
Sure, sure. Let's get into some of the specifics. What did you feel about performances-wise? Who did you like? Who did you like less? Whatever.
I liked everybody. I really thought this was a strong ensemble. I mean, like I said, it's cool as fuck. Like, this is like, Ocean's 11 with teeth.
Okay.
You know, like, I feel like the casting was spot on. I mean, there's some twists and turns I don't want to give away. Mm-hmm. But John Hamm's performance, he was cast so well. Mm-hmm. Cause he's sort of a likable rogue at first. And then there's, like I said, some twists and he can be quite menacing as well. Right. Same with Kevin Spacey. He has the menace, but he has a soft side too that I totally bought.
I would say this is pretty well-worn territory for Spacey, though.
Oh, sure. I mean, he was cast with intention.
Right.
It was deliberate, his role. I think kind of the same with, Jamie Foxx. He's sort of playing the inverse of his character in Collateral.
Yeah.
And he's just having so much fun with it.
Mm-hmm. Also kind of playing his character from the Horrible Bosses, but he was actually competent.
Yeah, he's
if he was the scary criminal that he pretended to be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Ansel Elgort, I've only seen him in a couple things, this and The Fault in Our Stars, but I think he, like, I totally dug him.
Can I take a minute? Can I pause the podcast for a little bit just to pat myself on the back?
Sure. What?
I do this every once in a while. I feel as though I should be a casting director because I'm very good at picking out the future stars of America. When I saw Ansel Elgort perform as the boyfriend character in the Carrie remake, which I hated. I completely had nothing nice to say about that remake, the one with Chloe Moretz. But mm-hmm. I remember saying at the time when we reviewed it back then, that kid they got to play the boyfriend, he's kind of good. He might go somewhere.
Okay, that's not the same as like saying this kid's gonna be a star someday.
No, like, but I did point out that he was the diamond in the rough.
Sure.
And I called out Bradley Cooper before anybody had any faith in him. I'm just saying.
Okay.
Continue.
Ansel Elgort was really good. He was also very good in The Fault in Our Stars. I liked him more in this. And to me, this movie, like, it kind of depends on the likability of Baby because he is different than the criminal element that he's sort of checked in with. Mm-hmm. He has a sensitive side and that has to play, but in a way that's not dull. And honestly, he has the least amount of dialogue to work with.
Right.
He doesn't really talk a whole lot, but you get him. I think he does a really good, subtle, nuanced performance for this character. So I was very happy with him. I sort of thought he is to Baby Driver what the opposite of Michael Cera and Scott Pilgrim is. Like Scott Pilgrim versus the World is sort of good despite Michael Cera being really inappropriately cast.
You're saying this is a person who read the comics.
No, maybe a little, but he's the worst part of that movie. We're not getting into Scott Pilgrim.
You don't want to relitigate Scott Pilgrim.
I'm just saying that I felt like Ansel Elgort totally fit the role of Baby, whereas Michael Cera took me out because he was so Michael Cera.
Okay. You know what? I'm now that I've just rained all this praise on Ansel Elgort and talking about how I plucked him out of obscurity for the world.
Yes, it was you.
It was me. I was the one who did it. I actually think he is neither a positive nor a negative. I think he's sort of neutral in the movie. I think he's definitely sort of he's a cipher. And in a way that say like,
yeah, you gotta relate to the kid. You gotta feel for him. As little dialogue as he has, he has like all of this choreography to do. Yes. He's the closest one to actually break out into song. Nah, man.
No. You know, there's a few moments in here where he kind of gets to break out of his sort of cipherness. But I actually feel like something like, well, if we compare him to Ryan Gosling in Drive, because they're both sort of wordless performances.
Sure.
And they're both doing very similar things in the movies. But I think, you know,
they're very different.
They're very different movies. They're very tonally different characters. But I think that, you know, what Gosling is able to do with, you know, just tick of the eyebrow or, you know, his silent brooding, whatever, we don't really get anything of the tonal equivalent, of Baby Driver's tonal equivalent in Ansel Elgort all of the time.
Are you kidding me? Okay. He basically dances.
Sure.
He kind of sings. I mean, he lip syncs
right.
for his life.
Those moments are good.
He has to do sign language.
Actually, the moments where he's with his deaf caregiver.
Yeah.
Those are the moments I believe him the most. It's some of the others. I think his interactions with the other heavies in the movie, the other bad guys, that's where I kind of feel like he isn't quite at their level sometimes.
I'm going to have to disagree to agree with you on this one. Okay. Nope. Agree to disagree. I thought he was great. I think he's not the most exciting character, right. but I think he's kind of the linchpin. Like he's sort of the thing that grounds the movie. Mm-hmm. And you know, his chemistry with, Lily James, who I was not a fan of in Cinderella, I totally dug her in this.
Yeah, she was really good.
And I'm also kind of a sucker for that. Like, she's a waitress at a 50s diner, and she has this sort of like out of time element, where she kind of feels like she walked off the set of Twin Peaks or something. I'm sort of a sucker for that.
Mm-hmm.
But she pulls that off really well. And they have really good chemistry. Like, I believe their romance, which they also don't have a lot of time to really explore that. Mm-hmm.
The movie is very economic. I mean, it gets a lot accomplished story-wise and plot-wise without feeling really encumbered by exposition or trying to move from one thing to the other.
Well, and it kind of has to, because it also dedicates so much time to the soundtrack. Like, whereas like Drive, there's that opening sequence where they play like the whole song. He gets through almost the whole song of several songs in this. Like, right. There's the opening chase scene. There's the opening, the scene where he gets the coffee.
Mm-hmm.
There's more.
Right. and Edgar Wright will do fun things like where the baby is like changing the song, and then he kind of changes up the editing as the song changes, and or like, you know, he's recording tracks and doing weird things in his bedroom. And I mean, the movie is definitely really concerned with the process of making things, both the filmmaking presentation in and of itself. It's very, that's putting the artifice of film in your face, and then on top of it, Baby Driver's kind of deconstructing his own world in his head like a movie.
I guess.
More than anything, that's what the movie's, you know, in parentheses about.
Not every movie's about movies, Cassidy. Some movies are about car chases and music.
I think this movie, if it's about anything more than car chases and music, and I would like it to be, that's mostly what it is about. It's kind of just, very similar to how I felt about Damien Chazelle's creative approach to La La Land.
I loved La La Land. I loved it, but I kind of buy it a little more in this.
Okay.
If we have to compare them, and I do think that comparison is valid.
Mm-hmm.
Damien Chazelle's approach to La La Land felt a little, I could see how it could feel a little almost cold and mechanical because it's so focused on choreography and craft. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is just as focused on that, but it just feels a little more organic to me. I don't know.
Interesting. I would actually kind of say the opposite. I like Baby Driver. I'm going to put that out there. It's a positive review. Go see it. Go see it twice. I love the movie. It's fun. I'd like to see it again, actually.
It might be.
But But I actually feel that because Edgar Wright is, this is his first like sincere attempt at sort of participating in a genre rather than sending it up, that comedic distance, he hasn't quite bridged that with something else. And I still feel a little at arm's length from the movie.
Murmur. I could not. I don't want to say disagree because you are saying you liked it. Mm-hmm. I loved it. Like this is definitely in my top 10 of the year, like hands down. Okay. And it's been a good year for movies so
mm-hmm,
far.
Mm-hmm. And this is a great little fun, you know, sleeper hit or whatever. I don't know the numbers yet. I think it's doing well enough for its budget.
Yeah.
To come out in the middle of, you know, Transformers season, this is a great alternative to that.
I just so dug this movie. Like, it's one of my favorites by Edgar Wright so far, and I love Edgar Wright.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think the only movie that maybe outdoes it still is Hot Fuzz, because that movie is amazing. That movie's brilliant. And so is Baby Driver. I totally dug it. Car metaphor coming in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. I feel like it was firing on all cylinders.
And on that note, let's go ahead and move on to our last review, which is going to be the Tupac biopic, All Eyes on Me. This is directed by Benny Boom, who mostly has been, he has a couple small features under his belt, mostly worked in the world of music videos before this. They found on casting this lead, Demetrius Shipp Jr., who just so happens to look exactly like Tupac.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah. It's like, he is the best argument that for the Tupac is still alive theory.
Besides the pictures of Tupac being alive in Cuba.
I'm saying if he is alive, he has come back and is like trying to rebrand himself as Demetrius.
Right. So this basically tells a story, sort of a, you know, a birth to death story of, the rapper and actor Tupac Shakur, who we learn early on in the film was raised by a Black Panther single mother. She moves them to Baltimore, and when he's a teenager, he gets very heavily involved in the arts. Specifically, Shakespeare is his homie. And then, at the age of 17, he is then shipped to Oakland to make it on his own, where he gets involved in the hip hop scene, first as a dancer for Digital Underground before he breaks out on his own, right at the height of the early 90s gangster rap explosion. He becomes a very controversial figure very quickly. He believes that all eyes are on him, including the government and the police and all of these hangers on.
Would you call this the latest installment in the hip-hop-iverse?
Well, apparently everything has to be a universe now. You know, definitely this movie, I think, got made the way it did, if I'm allowed to sort of tease my criticisms, because of the success of Straight Outta Compton last year.
Oh, absolutely.
I feel like they really rushed this thing out to strike while the iron was hot there.
Let's get into it.
Yeah, you know, it's a Tupac movie. How about before we get into it, what was your knowledge of and appreciation for Tupac Shakur before seeing the movie?
Honestly, not very much. I think I knew more about, like, NWA, and honestly, not a lot. Like, you know, I'm familiar with some of the music. I knew he got shot.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I knew he was sort of the hip hop rap Kurt Cobain. Like, I did have a friend in high school who was super into Tupac.
Mm-hmm.
And he, you know, he would like write down Tupac lyrics and stuff. So I did always know that Tupac was well known as a lyricist. Maybe even enough to where he sort of transcended rap. But, and that isn't a diss, if you will, on rap. But more speaking to Tupac's legacy and influence.
Right, right.
Yeah, so not a lot. I'm familiar with the icon, but not very familiar with the person, with the story.
You know, I've had kind of an interesting relationship with the Tupac as well, because growing up,
With the Tupacs.
I kind of grew up sort of in an urban area. I was in Phoenix, Arizona when all of that stuff was really popular.
Ooh, tread lightly.
Oh, I am. But, you know, being like whatever years old I was, like 8 to 11 years old, I sort of lumped all of that sort of stuff together as like the same thing, you know, unfairly.
Yeah, me too. Like, it wasn't really my scene.
Yeah, I, to be fair, as a young little white nerd, I was sort of scared of all of it. It all seemed very extreme to me.
And yeah, that, well, like, I mean,
heavy metal seemed really extreme to me at the time.
Well, I totally get that. Like, you know, you look at the albums and sort of that thug image they were trying to portray. And if you're not of that culture, like, it can be threatening and alienating. And that's,
sure.
You know, and that isn't to say.
One thing.
I don't know, like that's kind of the image. Like, they wanted to look like, you know, he wanted to look like a gangster. He had Thug Life tattooed on his stomach. Like,
which you learn a little about his sort of philosophies, and that's sort of, you know, the coming around to it later in life. When I would look up these interviews and stuff, I don't know how, YouTube wormholes, I would end up on these interviews and I would actually hear like what he had to say, and it sounds so condescending for like a white, like, educated person to be like, he was very well spoken. But like, the some of the things he was saying was so prescient and like so before their time. Like, the things that are like in the political discussion now, he was saying to MTV on interview back in 1991. Yeah,
but you know, and a lot of those things he learned from the Black Panther movement, and, right. You know, and like, he wasn't the first one to be saying these things, but he was the first one to sort of take this, to use the culture in a way that
subvert the image of sort of the street thug as being sort of, a revolutionary.
That being said,
I mean, you compared him to the Kurt Cobain. I would say he's almost even more like the John Lennon of rap in that sense.
No, I could see that. I mean, you know, a lot of people compare Cobain to Lennon. Sure. I totally get that. Well, I think there's a little, there's a bit more of a fairness there too, because, Lennon and Tupac were both murdered, whereas, you know, Cobain, you know, he killed himself. I think that also affects their sort of iconic status. Like,
right, right.
You know, Tupac and Lennon were taken from us, whereas Cobain took himself from us, which is, I don't know. This is getting
weird. That being said, you had a point.
Yeah, that being said, it's a shame that his sort of, that they couldn't have done more with that in the movie, because I think that Tupac as a figure, there's a lot going on there, and there's a good movie to be had, and this was not it.
Not so much, unfortunately.
Yeah, I feel bad, because I wanted to like this movie. I liked Straight Outta Compton. I thought that one was great. This felt like someone who has seen enough biopics that he knows all the beats of a biopic.
Right.
But did not know how to put one together.
No, the editing, especially coming off the discussion of Edgar Wright, who's just kind of like, you know, editing is a second sense to him.
Yeah. There was so many.
This editing is so awkward.
And almost comical how bad some of the editing was, especially in the first third of the movie, like when we're seeing Tupac as a kid. So there's this weird framing device where he's being interviewed in jail, which is fine. Like, I'm not against framing devices, but they would cut back and forth between him like being interviewed and the flashback scene so quickly that it both rendered the scene useless and the framing device useless. He would literally explain what we just saw.
What we just saw, yeah. And my beef with framing devices in general, especially that kind of framing device where it's the interview or that's a guy going back writing a letter and narration, is if you're not using the narration, you're not using the interview framing device in a way that informs the scene we just saw, but rather just kind of re-explain literally. I mean, I was baffled.
Well, it was like that movie. Did you ever see that movie, Don't Be a Menace to South Central While Drinking Your Juice in the Hood?
Sure, yeah.
So yeah, it's this parody of, you know, the hood movies. And whenever they would have like a sincere moment, someone would pop up and go, "Message!"
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is one of my favorite jokes in that movie. That movie's whatever, but that joke I always thought was really funny. And whenever I see something in a movie that's like so obviously like on the nose, I will sometimes do that without even realizing it. I'll right, go, yeah. "Message."
Mm-hmm.
It's a very obtuse reference to explain to people too. So if you're ever around me and I do that, just know that that's what that's from.
That's basically what's happening.
Yeah, basically, every scene in the first hour of this movie was like that. Like, I felt bad because I felt like everyone thought they were making a better movie than they were. Like,
yes, specifically Demetrius Shipp Jr., who I think is there's nothing to blame him on.
Like, no,
he's actually really good in the movie.
And I actually don't think any of the performances were bad. The mom could be a little over the top, but that could have been some of the editing, shoving it in your face.
I felt like she was often over the top. There's a few good moments with her and Tupac, some one-on-ones, and there's some.
Okay. Well, but the problem is, I think her acting is fine. It's that we don't have the proper context.
Right.
So she's like always intense. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if they had had scenes that were allowed to breathe and actually had some like subtext and nuance, she could have found some more layers. I might have been a good performance somewhere between takes.
Right.
But it just got edited out so that we would only see the dramatic stuff. Mm-hmm. That's all this movie was like, let's just show the dramatic stuff. And yeah, so basically, I thought this movie was a bit of a slog. I did think there was some fun to be had a little later, like once he becomes Tupac. And that's sort of, I think, when the movie found whatever legs it had. We got some fun scenes with, what's his name? Big Scary. Suge Knight?
Suge Knight, yeah.
Yeah, who is the Phil Coulson of the hip-hop-iverse.
You know, yeah, some of that stuff works on sort of a crime movie level. And I think that some of the concert sequences I actually like.
That's what I mean.
That like, stuff kind of like peps up the movie a little bit. And obviously Benny Boom, who mostly worked in music videos, was a little more comfortable in those sequences.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's where we start to see like, oh yeah, like we start to get it. Like, oh yeah, he was charismatic. He was a performer. Like, once we see him step into that persona, I was having a lot more fun with the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't enough to, like, save it or make it a good movie.
Right. I think a lot of the problem with this movie is a lot of the problems I have with mediocre biopics, which is they tell this kind of big overviewing story rather than focusing on a moment or focusing on a specific, you know, arc within his life to sort of highlight.
Compare this to Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs.
Sure.
You know, where we're seeing like a very narrowed in like three specific times in his life.
Mm-hmm.
That's not a great biopic, but it's a good character study.
Right. Exactly. You
know, I don't know how accurate it is, but I didn't care because it was depicting a good character. Mm-hmm. You know, we got a full arc, whereas this movie's sort of
painfully linear.
Yeah.
And it feels very episodic. We got to move from one thing to the other, to the other, to the other, to the other, till we know we're going to hit all the beats that you know about. And yeah,
it also, like, I think, again, I don't know a whole lot about, I didn't know a whole lot about Tupac going into this. Mm-hmm. But it also felt like they were kind of sugarcoating some stuff.
Oh, yeah. If you want to get into the sexual politics, you know, I don't necessarily have a problem with how they decided to go with that, because I feel like that's a thing where before you start writing the script, you have to make a decision.
Yeah.
On how you feel about that event.
No, it's not even just that either, though. It's like there's all these references to him getting arrested and mm-hmm. being a troublemaker and stuff, but we never
and it's really somehow never his fault. Yeah,
it's never his fault, and we never actually see it. Like, there's right. even a moment where, like, someone picks up a newspaper and like references it, and he's like, "Oh man, all these damn lawyers are coming after my money. You gotta stop getting arrested, Tupac." And I'm like, "Wait, what the fuck?" Like, we've seen him in jail once.
I think that was, a very lazy way, obviously, but I think it was just a way to sort of say the police were on his nuts the whole time.
And I get that. I feel like the movie was trying to portray him so good, like as such a sort of saint, mm-hmm. that it felt very fake to me. And I'm not saying
there's a little bit of a rise and fall Icarus story there with his when he moves into, like you said, the second half, when he kind of joins up with Death Row Records, and there's a little bit of kind of selling your soul to the devil kind of thing.
But again, we don't really see him doing those things. It's still like, it's sort of making him look like a victim, like entirely.
Sure, and, totally.
And yes, he was murdered. He was a murder victim. But I don't know that this is going to sound so fucking pretentious, but I don't know that that's necessarily how Tupac would have wanted to be portrayed. Like his message, according to the movie, was, he's reporting from the streets and he's reporting honestly. And I feel like this movie was kind of dishonest about that. And so that sort of undercuts that message, if that makes sense.
Right. I mean, it's definitely trying to sort of show him in a more positive light all the way through. I think they challenge it a little bit here or there, but not very much.
I don't think so. I think it felt very like we can't make Tupac look bad. We're all in agreement, right, guys? Like, we can't do anything to tarnish the legacy of Tupac. And I think, you know, maybe a little more of a warts and all approach might have helped. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't have helped the lazy editing and the shoddy script writing, but
right.
I think it might have made it at least a little bit more complete as a character arc. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I mean, overall, here's the deal. It's like, this is the only Tupac movie we have. So if you're writing a paper about Tupac and you need some reference, obviously there's probably books and interviews and that kind of stuff would be more useful. But as being the only Tupac movie that exists, it'll have to do.
That's true.
It's not a great film. It's basically a VH1 original writ large.
Yeah. That's actually exactly what it felt like to me, was like a VH1 original. Like, yeah. Also, I guess, I don't know if you know about this, but apparently Jada Pinkett had some beef.
Oh, I wonder why.
Yeah. Well, yeah. She said pretty much straight up that, like, all the scenes that happened with her were, like, not accurate remotely.
Well, no, because she pretty much just jumps in the movie to say everything the audience is thinking and then jumps out of the movie again.
Yeah, and it's very much like
she's a writing device.
And it's very much like, oh, look, here's a reference that people will understand. Like,
oh, actually, if you want to talk about obtuse things, you were talking about message from Don't Be a Menace. And I think I mention this almost every time we do a lazy biopic. Mark Kermode, the British film critic, he came up with an ism called the chubby hum moment, which is a reference to the Carpenters TV movie from the 70s or the early or late 80s, whatever. Mm-hmm. In which Karen Carpenter is reading their first review and it mentions something about her being chubby. And she says, chubby, and this movie is full of chubby moments.
Okay, so...
Skippable.
Yeah, definitely. Like you said, if you're a fan of Tupac, there's stuff you'll like there. Right. I do think there is some fun stuff near the end.
Mm-hmm. And a good central performance. I don't know what Demetrius Shipp Jr. can do other than be Tupac.
Well, he can do every role that Tupac would have been up for.
Okay.
yeah, no, I that is the one thing. Their Tupac was like, he was spot on.
But he, and to his credit, he doesn't just lean on looking a lot like him. He actually physically embodies the person.
Yeah, I would say if you're, like you said, if you're writing a book report or whatever, just for his performance, there was enough watchability for me to kind of get through it. That's sort of some of the acting is sort of what kept it from becoming laughably bad to me.
Yeah, except for when it was. I mean, there's a good handful.
Oh,
of
there's some.
When
yeah,
the
there's
movie
some,
tilts full onto blaxploitation.
For sure. So we didn't give Baby Driver a grade.
Oh, for me, Baby Driver's a B+.
For me, it was an A+.
All right.
Like, knocked it out of the park. This was a D-.
It's not that bad. I'm gonna give it a D+. There's a couple highlights, but yeah, it's not good.
No, it's very bad. Now moving on, because I'm not gonna let you forget about this motherfucker, to our Netflix homework, which I fucking watched and you fucking didn't.
Which our listeners fucking can't because Netflix took it off.
Well, maybe they watched it after we recommended it maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago or whenever the last time we actually recorded was.
Right.
So the Netflix homework was Glengarry Glen Ross. What is going on here? So we've got an office full of salesmen that are complaining about their leads that they're getting to make sales. Another Kevin Spacey movie, by the way. And it's just sort of like a night in their life dealing with this profession that's sort of leaving them behind. And it is a star-studded at the time cast. Al Pacino, Jack Lemmon, Alec Baldwin, Alan Arkin, Ed Harris, and Kevin Spacey are the main characters. As we all know, Alec Baldwin has his famous moment. Coffee is for closers. Cookies are for closers. He was in the movie much less than I realized. He was literally only in it for that scene.
Right.
Yeah, which is sort of insane. Like
a famous David Mamet monologue. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just like such a famous part in his career that was just based on, you know, maybe 5 minutes screen time. Pretty impressive. Yeah. So what I'll say about this movie is, I mean, it's a little dated. I mean, the subject matter alone, but it also, like, it's very 90s feeling, like very 90s drama. But it's worth it just to, like, watch all these amazing actors churn out, like, real acting performances. Like, these are roles made to chew scenery with.
Right.
And it's worth it just to like see all these actors in their heyday playing their A game. Like, I mean, Kevin Spacey he's a little younger. So he also doesn't have a huge part. But he has a great turn too. Yeah. The story, I think might be dated enough that it, just like the central plot of these like salesmen, like having to like cold call people and go door to door and like, I don't know. It feels so almost otherworldly at this point.
Right. Would you say that there's no modern day analog? Is it not like talking about capitalism as a whole or something like that?
No, it definitely is, especially Alec Baldwin's part. Like, that's definitely like a send up of that corporate structure, mm-hmm. which is pretty funny. So I worked at a telemarketing place uh-huh. for a little bit, and he has the famous line, always be closing, and it's like written on a chalkboard, like ABCs, like those are the ABCs of selling, always right. be closing. And we had this poster that said, always be calling, and it was like it's set up the same way as he had written it on the chalkboard, and it's like, you guys didn't get that that was like a take. Like, that was satirizing this corporate culture.
Mm-hmm. If we want to talk about that, like, the reason, one of the reasons we decided to talk about this movie is because that monologue sort of became resurrected or became popular again through a really popular Cracked article that was floating around about 4 or so years ago. It was one of the first of many Millennials Are Lazy and Stupid articles. Mm-hmm. It was like the first one. It was the mothership of these horrible trend in articles, where they use that monologue as their dogma to which all millennials should aspire to and where they're falling short. Having seen it in context, how shitty was that article?
Oh my God, so shitty. I don't think I've read this article. Like his character is literally like saying, we don't care about you as people. You're garbage unless you can find your place in this arbitrary workforce. Like,
right.
All of the employees are completely frustrated. They feel like they've been given shit leads. All the characters are getting pretty desperate. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the office gets robbed, and you don't know sort of which character did it. So there's a bit of a whodunit here that's kind of fun. I mean, you can figure it out if you're observant. Mm-hmm. It's not like a twist, but it is, you know, sort of a reveal. Anyway, it's definitely a send up of that, because Alec Baldwin is literally the one making them miserable in this corporate environment that's dehumanizing them. It's literally like stripping away their individuality and humanity. And saying, like, if you can't be cogs in this machine, you're garbage. Like, he literally says, I'm a better person than you because I have a Rolex.
Yeah, in that article, I remember reading it, and it was like being floated around, like, so, like, by people you know, online and stuff that you would think would not be floating these kind of articles around. And to their defense, there wasn't that many of those kind of articles then. And mm-hmm. I guess it was supposed to seem like a splash of water in the face. But I remember just reading that and being like, you know what? Maybe it's unhealthy to look at your entire well-being as how much you can or can't produce for a workforce.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, Alec Baldwin's character is not – like, if you watch Glengarry Glen Ross and you come out of it being like, oh, yeah, he had a good point at the beginning there when he was ruining everyone's lives. Then maybe, like, double-check some priorities.
All that being said,
I would say this movie is definitely worth watching just to watch, like, actors act. Mm-hmm. Like, just to watch them, like, hone their craft and perform the shit out of a script that was meant for strong leading men.
Right. The other question I would ask, having not seen it, so it's based on a play. It was performed mm-hmm. as a play before it was a movie. A lot of times with those sort of adaptations, especially modern day plays, that maybe have fewer locations, mm-hmm. does it feel stagey?
A little. I mean, not in a way like the movie Chicago. Okay. Which is literally like has them performing on a stage for.
I don't know if that counts because that's obviously drawing attention to that. But you know, a lot of times when you see movies that are based on like off Broadway things or whatever, and it's just in one apartment or something like that, and it's very dialogue driven. Mm-hmm. Even like the early films of Neil LaBute, who I adore. Even some of his stuff, it's like, okay, this monologue would work a lot better on a stage than it does with a tight frame.
Yes and no. I feel like there are a couple moments that you can feel it.
Mm-hmm.
But like sort of the first half of the movie does.
Okay.
But then once the theft occurs in the office, I actually feel like that is pretty deftly directed. So
okay.
In the first half, there's a few more location changes, and those are what sort of feel a little more awkward.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's like a Chinese food place, like right across the street that they walk to.
Mm-hmm.
And that just feels a little like convenient. For a stage, it makes sense, but for a movie, it feels a little weird.
Mm-hmm.
But then the whole second half takes place in the, basically anytime they're in the office, it feels like, okay, it's sort of like 12 Angry Men.
Sure, yeah.
In that sense. But whenever they leave the office, which isn't very often, it does feel a little stagey, a little awkward.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, but it feels cinematic enough.
Yeah.
All right.
But I think that's because you have good cinematic actors. You know, right. like this is the kind of performance that, you know, Al Pacino's famous for. Like,
right.
If anything, it's worth it watching for him because it's like, oh, holy shit. I forgot this guy could act back when he,
right.
You know, was still capable of portraying human emotion.
But a lot of these guys, I mean, Kevin Spacey, Jack Lemmon, Al Pacino, they're no stranger to the stage either.
No. But Jack Lemmon, especially, I know he did a lot on Broadway, but it felt like actors in their element. So mm-hmm. I think that helped.
And Kevin Spacey was Jack Lemmon's protege coming up in the world of stage acting.
Oh, well, that's fun.
Okay, cool. Well, we got a fairly decent one-sided review there for the Netflix homework that I couldn't do and you can't watch. For next week's Netflix homework, I'm going to assign you Andrew Haig's Weekend, which, unlike The Babadook, was appropriately categorized in the LGBT section. Given that the Pride Month has just ended, and I guess it's still kind of happening in other cities, I figure, why not go gay?
Okay.
That concludes our laborious episode.
Yeah. This was
so much behind the scenes of this one. But
this is a two-day podcast.
We've been podcasting for 2 days straight. Whatever you're hearing is whittled from that.
Please call in and donate.
To our cause.
To our pre-recorded podcast telethon.
Right. Okay, so promote yourself.
Oh, Jesus. So tonight in San Diego's back. We're doing new episodes. If you're in San Diego, come downtown to check our shows out. We've actually been getting really good crowds, so uh-huh. It's a good idea to get your tickets in advance at tonightinsandiego.com.
Uh-huh.
You can follow that on all the social meds.
Uh-huh.
You can follow me on all the social meds at Keith Foster Kid, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. I also have a new website at www.keithfosterkid.com. So you can, I have a calendar that you can check out for live dates.
Mm-hmm. And it has all of your links to all your stuff, including a link back here to Jabber and the Drone.
Yep, all my links. There's also a little blog that I've only done one entry for, that I'm gonna work on at some point.
Okay.
But the more people like actually click on it and read it, the more likely I am to do it. Even though the first one is just like, yeah, look, I have a blog.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. And if anybody wants to email the show and give us any of your thoughts on anything we talked about in this episode or previous episodes, you can do so at jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also find the show and listen to our podcast archives or find our RSS feed at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can do so at Jabber Podcast. You can follow me individually at BC Cassidy, B as in Victor. What else? You can find the podcast on podcatchers such as Google Play, Player.fm, Pocket Cast, the Windows Podcast Network, and obviously iTunes, and Stitcher Radio. If you're on Stitcher and iTunes, please leave like a one-sentence review and a star rating. And You should be listening to our friends who also do podcasts, which include Rod and Denise at The Listening Party, which we did an episode of a long time ago, but they're, you know, they just put one up.
Yeah, I actually had a suggestion for them as a theme based on Baby Driver, because one of the central elements, there's a fun bit of dialogue about how there's a lot of movies that are a lot of songs with baby in them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they should do a Baby Driver episode where it's songs with baby.
Oh, they might have done that. I don't remember. You should also be listening to Denise's spinoff show, The Mascot Diaries, and Patrick and Dennis at Almost Educational, which I think I referenced somewhere in this episode, and Patrick and his dad at Make Dad Read Comics.
I actually I have some other friends that are trying to get into the podcast game. I think they have a couple episodes up. Go to www.blizzlet.com.
Can you spell that?
BLIZZLET.com. It's super nerdy. They talk about the game Hearthstone. It's literally just them like talking about this game. I don't know. I haven't listened to it yet. I'm going to. I'm not into Hearthstone, but they used to be, well, they're still in the Comedy Project.
Right.
So it's a couple of veterans who are doing this.
Hmm.
Just check it out.
Down Home Pocatello Podcast.
Yeah, just check it out, guys. Like, they could use it. You know, sure. We all got started somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They only have like two episodes and they're already getting plugged on other podcasts.
There
so
you go.
They're doing all right.
They're doing pretty good. All right. Well, that concludes the episode, and I will speak with you next week.
That's right. I don't know which closing I like more. But in honor of the Netflix homework that you didn't watch, we'll end with Cookies Are for Closers.
Mm-hmm. Both a Glengarry Glen Ross and a baby reference. Bye.